Welcome to Breaking Banks, the number one global fintech radio show and podcast. I'm Brett King.
And I'm Jason Henricks. Every week since 2013, we explore the personalities, startups, innovators, and industry players driving disruption in financial services.
From incumbents to unicorns, and from cutting-edge technology to the people using it to help create a more innovative, inclusive, and healthy financial future. I'm JP Nichols, and this is Breaking Banks.
Welcome to Breaking Banks. I am your host, Brett King. This is the number one fintech podcast and radio show in the world. I'm glad you come back. This week we have some great OGs of fintech joining us from Hong Kong in the almost corona-free zone is Matt Dooley. Matt, welcome back on the show. It's been a little while.
Thanks, Brett. Yes, the first time we connected, I think there was only 1 million cases in COVID, and we were talking about everything that we should do and you must wear a mask.
But, yes.
That was a year ago.
It's indeed. And so now, obviously, things are a little different. 500,000 cases in the United States already, 500,000 deaths, rather, in the United States already. I don't know how many cases there are, but tons. So if you don't know Matt, Matt can be found at the top of many fintech influencer lists. He's also a fintech and customer experience executive. He's worked at two of the world's leading banks. He's got a ton of experience in digital transformation and working across the globe in the space. Previously spent some time in the UK and been based in Hong Kong for 25 years. Is that right, Matt?
Yeah, 26 now.
Like me, you're a reformed Aussie.
Yes, always on the road.
Yeah, I left Oz in 99, so it's pretty close in terms of time frame. Very good. Also joining us all the way from Blighty, the United Kingdom, a very special guest is Alistair Lukies. Alistair and I have known each other for a number of years. He's the UK businessman and entrepreneur, best known as the pioneer and champion for UK's global fintech industry. Today, he is the founder and CEO of Pollinate International. He is on the Prime Minister's Business Council and a member of the Prime Minister's Business Council. Prior to that, he was appointed by the UK Prime Minister. This is when it was the Honourable David Cameron to be the Prime Minister's Business Ambassador for FinTech in the UK. And he's also the chair of the FinTech Alliance, which is in partnership with the UK government, is a multifaceted digital engagement platform that works on bringing the FinTech ecosystem together. Now, this has obviously paid off because the UK is one of the, I was going to say one of the top, fintech locations in Europe, but of course, technically not part of Europe anymore, but one of the top fintech cities in the world, London, employs more fintech people than anywhere else in the world, I understand. But Alistair, welcome to the show.
It's great to see you, mate. And great to be back in touch. I think the last time we were together was in Bahrain, of all places.
I think so.
And it's really nice to connect with you and Matt, who, of course, his reputation precedes him. So it's a really nice connection to make. And when he said last time we spoke, it was a million. I thought he was going to say only a million viewers or listeners to your podcast. That would have been a long time ago.
Yeah.
But we were talking COVID cases. And actually, just to make a geographic point, we are, of course, still part of Europe. We're just not part of the Eurozone.
Yes, of course.
And still very, very proud Europeans in so many ways, he says, with
absolutely
complete authenticity. Very good to be here, mate.
Well, good. Well, let's jump in. First of all, let's go back. Before we jump into Pollinate and what you're doing, maybe tell us the story about how the UK got fintech. You know, what was it that led to David Cameron's office and You know, the Mayor of London and, you know, the UK Trade and Investment Department. You know, what was it that led to the UK's interest in fintech?
Yeah, it was total necessity. It is actually genuinely a brilliant story, whether you're into fintech or not. It's fascinating because, of course, the UK for so many years, you know, had this proud kind of financial services sector in London. Although, you know, I think before the likes of you came along, Brett, it would be fair to say, yeah, there wasn't a huge amount of innovation going on, and you had a closed group. In fact, those of you that are listening who haven't been to London, you have in the centre of the city of London, you have the Bank of England, and next to it, you have the Royal Exchange. And then each of the four clearing banks, as we call them, so what's HSBC, where Matt used to work today, used to be Midland Bank, Barclays, Lloyds, and National Westminster Bank, also known as Royal Bank of Scotland, have their headquarters, or used to have their headquarters, all on the corners of the square where the Bank of England was. And they ruled the roost, right? That was it. And they were the banks, and they decided what happened, and they worked closely with government and had sort of all sorts of self-regulatory bodies. In fact, a little known fact, Theresa May, our previous prime minister, used to be the head of communications for the Association of Payment and Clearing Services, which was the bank's way of stopping the government regulating payments. They said, we'll do it ourselves, and had a self-appointed body to keep them all in check, in inverted commas. So, yeah, it really was a case that London was the huge financial services centre, pretty sleepy, pretty robust. And then, of course, 2008 came along. And, you know, Royal Bank of Scotland under the infamous Fred Goodwin had decided that, yeah, the only way to go was go big or go home. Fifth biggest bank in the world, owned 5% of Bank of China, bought ABN AMRO. Huge global sprawling bank, not really that interested in its retail bank anymore, to be fair, just kind of making lots of money from all sorts of exotic stuff. And then the GFC happened and the whole thing collapsed. And, you know, it wasn't just an impact on banking, it was an impact on society at large, as we all know. And only the Aussies, because of their prudential authority and, you know, bloody good pension schemes, same as the Canadians, came through it okay.
And because they're so far from everywhere else in the world.
Only an Aussie can say that. we'll come on to that later, but doing the fintech bridge with Scott Morrison when he was the treasurer was actually an absolute delight. Talk about that in a minute. But so ScoMo. So to answer your question, yeah, what happened is you've got 19% of the UK's GDP, 2.3 million jobs in financial services and associated industries, 37% of Europe's financial services industry based in London, and it all goes pop. So you go, what do we do? Because you can't be positive about banking. No politician's going to stand up and say, forgive them. You know, it wasn't their fault they bust the world. And so it just became this awful political hot potato. And of course, you know, the opposition were just saying, tear down the banks, tear down the wall. Felt very Pink Floyd. And so we sort of, a group of us just hustled a bit and said, what are we going to do about this? And I was lucky enough, I was then the CEO of another sort of fintech company, one of the early ones, a company called Monetize, which I founded in 2002.
Yeah, you know, Monetize.
We were having a pretty good run of it at the time. Didn't have such a nice end, but yeah, it was going well. We were the first sort of unicorn, so we were about $1 billion market cap in around 2009. And I was on a trade mission to Africa with David Cameron, and we were talking about, what do you do? You know, how do you talk about financial services without getting slaughtered? And we said, we've got to move the conversation on. It can't just be about the four big banks anymore. It's got to be about, you know, the future of financial services, fintech. And so a whole load of things then all happened, if you planned it, you wouldn't have got it right. So the regulator, you know, one of the good things we have in the UK is the FCA. So we have this one regulator which has two hats. It has to drive competition as well as being the prudential authority. So it's got carrot and stick. And so the regulator started to say, well, look, we can't just leave it to these four big banks anymore. So they issued a whole load of banking licenses, which I'm fairly sure there was quite a smart guy called Brett King, who for many, many years was talking about neobanks and the fact that you needed, you know, more competition in the market to move the conversation on. And so, you know, we've now got 23 new banks. We hadn't had a new clearing bank for 250 years before that. And the regulator set up the sandbox. You know, we created something called Innovate Finance, which I was the inaugural chair of. That was very important. And, you know, if you look at the great work Matt does in Hong Kong, it was really important to have a voice for the whole industry. So, you know, HSBC at one end, but Fred in the shed at the other end, because, yeah, the British Bankers Association, you know, turn up to government and say, British Bankers Association turn up to the government and say, please stop beating up the banks, right? It's a wolf in a wolf's clothing, and the government says no. But if you get a trade body, as we did with Innovate Finance, that says, look, just whacking the banks every day doesn't fix the issue, right? Just telling them off doesn't fix the issue. What you've got to do is open up the network. And that's where, you know, PSD2, we were the first to adopt that. Open banking came along, now GDPR, and those things blended gave us the kind of API economy that we have today. And so, sort of just to finish the ramble, but, you know, what's so important and what we had to do to keep financial services front of mind and all the new jobs you kindly referred to, so 78,000 new jobs in fintech in the last 5 years, inward investment of $39 billion last year. What we had to do is we had to say, how do you fuse old and new, big and small, innovator and incumbent? How do you make that happen? And to be fair to the industry, I mean, he didn't have a lot of choice, but the industry bought into it. And, you know, a lot of the banks kind of went, yeah, you know, mea culpa, fair enough. And so what you've now got is a lot of work. You know, of course you hear about the Monzos and the Starlings and the neobanks, and that's great. It gets lots of press. But what's much more exciting for me is the infrastructure stuff. So what you've now got is loads of enablers, loads of B2B to C companies working with the banks and getting the banks distribution. So, yeah, that's
roughly how many fintech companies do you think there are in London these days?
In London, there's about 400 what you would call true fintech companies, which is a good size. And of those, you've got well over 10 that have sort of made it, you know, to scale, so above half a billion market cap. Yeah. But it's not just a London thing. Yeah, that's the other thing. You know, it is I have to do my level up piece for the Prime Minister, but it is true. You know, if you go to Manchester, if you go to Leeds, if you go to Newcastle, if you go to Edinburgh, if you go to Cardiff, there's actually some really cool clusters doing different things. And one of the things that the Americans have really struggled with in this space is, you know, we've got, as you guys know, in London, in one square mile, you've got regulator, you've got banks, you've got London Stock Exchange, you've got the whole thing, you know, all in one area. In America, you've got Silicon Valley writing code to rule the world and, you know, eat everything up. You've got New York on the other coast, 3,000 miles away, and then you've got Washington trying to regulate the whole thing.
Right.
And you've got state-level regulation, so it's pretty difficult to fuse it all together.
70 regulators in the US.
Yeah.
It's pretty crazy. FCA has done, I think, extraordinarily well. You know, their tech sprint approach, I think, is sort of defined how regulators should engage with the broader community. But, Matt, in Hong Kong, we had a slightly different approach. When fintech started to impact, certainly in the early years of fintech, it was largely dismissed in Hong Kong, and the incumbents were favored. And then there was this sudden turnaround, like what it was in like late 2017 or was it 2018? I can't remember, where Norman Chan sort of brought out those seven new rules for HKMA, and suddenly overnight it changed. But, you know, maybe having lived through that, you know, how would you compare Hong Kong's journey to the UK's journey in respect to becoming aware of how important fintech was?
There's so many parallels. The density of the banks, or the geographic density of having the regulators in the same buildings and surrounded by the banks, is fantastic. So in a square mile in Hong Kong, you've virtually got the top 100 banks, or 84 of the top 100 banks in Asia, all headquartered here in Hong Kong. And you've got the regulators. But the regulators, well, what is the Central Bank of Hong Kong? It's actually, there's three note-issuing banks, and they tend to be HSBC, Standard Chartered, and Bank of China. So the three largest players in the market are the ones which is the quasi-central bank, and they're writing it. Totally what makes Hong Kong different to every other market that I've come across is the pride of Hong Kong is industry leads and government supports. Normally in a country, you would have a government would actually do or say the initiative and industry would actually support that initiative. So for Hong Kong, we were, as you just said, Alistair, it was fragmented. Fintech was in too many buckets, too many small operators, and not enough cohesion. We had blockchain associations. We had different alternative lending associations. We had tech organizations. We had financial services associations. So we created, and it took us 3 years of having the presentation and the pitch on a laptop to actually find the right bank to start with. And Marcus Steinbeck was the CEO at the time of Commonwealth Bank of Australia, their Hong Kong operations and their Macau operations. And now she leads, she's the CEO of Visa International here in Hong Kong and Macau. And she was instrumental because for the first time we could actually get a major bank to start saying, well, what are the real interests? And you want to find a bank that wants innovation and wants change to the industry. And they became a very strong partner. Now that 5 years on, and we're coming up to our sixth anniversary soon, the FinTech Association...
This is for the FinTech Association of Hong Kong, right?
For the FinTech Association of Hong Kong. We have 1,700 practitioners. We have over 300 organizations, and we have the big tech players of China that are now members. We have the largest banks. HSBC is very active in it. We have Standard Chartered. We have smaller, mid-sized banks that are wanting to innovate, and they're using the association because we have all the fintech founders to help the education, help the cultural change that's required in their bank. But the beauty about digital is it's not about fintech. It's not about financial services. And just north of Hong Kong, you've got Shenzhen and you've got Tencent and you've got Alibaba just north of there in Hangzhou. And they've really shown the way of how do you embed financial services into everyday digital life. And Brett, congratulations on Augmented. Your book is now becoming a TV series.
Okay. It is pretty cool to have
You were ahead in the sense of picking that moment where financial services is just an algorithm that sits underneath everyday experiences.
Exactly. Embedded experiences.
And that's where it is.
How do you think, Alistair, the fintech banking license, you gave it a short mention in your opening blurb there, but, there's now, we've seen a bunch of other countries follow that recipe, Singapore, Hong Kong, Australia. The US is still resistant to it. Yeah, Malaysia. The US is still somewhat resistant to a fintech license because of the regulatory structural problems in the US that would mean that a digital player doesn't have a level playing field with an incumbent, which is the hang-up. But how instrumental do you think that was in terms of really changing the nature of challenger banks and neobanks globally?
Yeah, I mean, I think, success breeds success, obviously. And so when you see, these businesses, dear old Anthony Thompson's just done it again down in Oz,
hasn't he? He's just on fire, that guy.
He's got, the model's not broken, so why not just keep cutting and pasting it? And actually, I would say this, I'm a bit biased because I'm such a huge fan of Ross McEwan, but, NAB are making some pretty smart moves down there. and you know, bringing together their own Neo offering with a you know, great modern platform, merging the two things together is you know, is a smart play. And I think, you know, perhaps we'll come on to talk about this. I think a lot of Neo banks kind of hope that M&A is going to be their savior, because not all of them are going to get to scale. Big question mark over that. But I think, to your question, Brett, it definitely, yeah, it's a good, it was a great stick. You know, a guy called Chris Woolard, who was the head of the FCA Sandbox Project Innovate, as we call it, super smart guy. And he went to the banks and said, guys, you know, you've had your chance, you've had your time. Let's show you how it's done. And encourage these neobanks to do exactly what you've described, which is treat financial services as just another lifestyle thing that you do. You know, you don't want a mortgage, yeah. You want to move house. You know, you don't want a loan, you want to build a business. It's just, to us, it's very simple. But when you were able to show it and you were able to see these banks get to scale, we had seen it happen, you know, a lot. People forget about First Direct. I love First Direct. And a guy called Mike Harris, super smart guy who built Egg and First Direct back in the 90s. Yeah, he did a deal with HSBC where he just said, look, you do the back office, you do the infrastructure. I'll create two call centers and we'll just be all about direct. We'll be all about customer service. And it's still the most recommended bank in the UK today, First Direct. HSBC kind of messed that up because they ended up getting scared of it. They thought they'd created a Frankenstein that was going to outgrow them. So they stymied its growth a bit. But to your point on the US, the thing to watch for me is Goldman, right? If you look at what Goldman are doing, yes, in the adjacency with Marcus, what they're doing with Amazon, what they've done with the Apple Card, you know, super smart adjacency.
And not even plays. A traditional retailer, but they've...
No, that but place. That's... Yeah. It's, if you think of it like the mobile industry guys, you know, the MVNOs, which was all the rage in the late 90s. So Richard Branson turns up to T-Mobile and says, I don't want to build a mobile network, but I want to offer mobile phones. So I'll just use your network. I'll pay you for it as a wholesaler and I'll create a new brand. And lots of people did it. It's exactly the same thing. It's the mobile virtual banking operator where banks and Standard Chartered do this already in many markets. You know, that's why M-Pesa exists in Kenya. They say, we'll provide the back end. You guys go do the distribution and just pay us per account. So I think you're going to see more of that in America. I think Goldman are playing a very, very smart adjacency game there. But I do agree with you. You know, why would you set up a neobank that can only work in Idaho, right? It's not going to scale.
It's funny. Like Macquarie Bank in Australia has done a similar thing. They bought into fintechs. They understood banking. Yeah. And then they just saw these opportunities. And when they went to pitch it to the banks said, no, we'll do this ourselves. In absence of not being able to do it, they just said, damn it, we'll just create our own bank and do it.
It's great, being back in touch. And, Matt being in Hong Kong, where in the early days of Monetize, we were so lucky. We did a joint venture with a great character called Victor Chu, who runs a fund called First Eastern in Hong Kong and is the chair of the World Economic Forum Foundation Board. Super guy. And we ended up doing a deal with the Jardine family and Astra down in Indonesia, the biggest IPO company in Indonesia, who did everything from hotels, roads, motorbikes, insurance, and all the rest of it. And we used Permata Bank as the front end and then did a deal with BlackBerry, where you could do BlackBerry money. You could send money through Messenger and then get it out of an ATM. It's kind of another version of M-Pesa. But doing that with all of those different people involved was absolutely fascinating in that part of the world. And I think you're going to see, you know, huge amounts of that. I'm honored to chair something called the Africa Council for the UK government, where we aqueduct about 3.4 billion of aid into Africa each year. And rather than giving that money to corrupt politicians for them to build palaces, you know, we're investing it in companies that actually fix the problem. So if you need mosquito nets, let's build mosquito nets. And, you know, some of the fintech that's going on in Africa is all about that co-opetition, a mobile network, a bit of a bank, a bit of a retailer, you know, some local delivery people. You've sort of got the DoorDash thing going on at a local level. It's absolutely fascinating.
And the interesting thing about Africa and Asia is a lot of the smaller banks are actually owned by families that have all these other adjacent businesses,
exactly,
and industries that they can fuse everything around the customer.
Exactly.
The degrees of separation of fintech is if you know someone, and if you know Brett, you pretty much know one degree of separation from anyone else. But 25 years ago, I used to work for Darren Sugden, who was monetized, and Anthony Morris. And Anthony Morris was working on that project.
He was at Octopus, right? After HSBC.
He was at Octopus, but before that, he was at Monetize.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
That's right.
Correct.
Yeah, yes. Yeah. And
I think that's when I met him, actually.
We all worked on Mondex together, and Mondex got bought by MasterCard.
Tim Jones.
And basically, MasterCard just stopped it because it was too ahead of its time. It was electronic cash in 1996.
Yeah.
And Hong Kong, we created a. With Hang Seng Bank and Hong Kong Bank at the time, HSBC, they created a working model of electronic cash.
We're getting so melancholy. Yeah, we had a joint venture with Jetco in Hong Kong.
Oh man,
which Darren put together with Anthony, and there was a lady I think called Prudence Chan who was running Octopus at the time, ex Visa lady I think.
Octopus was such a huge success in those early days for the concept, but now they come under
hot water because of
data.
When you look at digital boils down banking to its absolute essence, and in that essence it's all about the data. And it's leveraging that data for insight, but also to connect opportunities. And that's what banking's all about, is connecting people with opportunities, connecting businesses with opportunities. And when I first went up to Hangzhou to have a look at Alibaba Group and their business, I was working at a bank at the time. And when we saw it, everyone thought that it was going to disrupt personal banking because they were doing the payments. But after that trip, and they were showing us about the supply chains and how they're building the warehouses and how everything would actually be connected, it became obvious that the real disruption of Alibaba and was not the payment piece. It was the SME would actually sit on their platform, and they would know what product was doing, who was buying the product.
Real time data.
Right back down.
They knew the value of their products, and they could give lending before the SME.
So this brings us actually, we're just going to have a quick break, but before that, I'll point to the fact that Monday, February 22nd, there was a really good story that came out on CNBC, and it was actually some comments from JP Morgan and Jamie Dimon in particular. But, Jamie has often commented about fintech. But in this particular report, it was saying that the real story of COVID-19 was fintech. Because fintech's become a big disruption. And while they still think Bitcoin is a bit of an economic sideshow, quote unquote, the fact digital finance is the real story, they're saying, in terms of a massive rally. Now, JP Morgan have done pretty well in respect to their own digital transformation journey. So during COVID-19, they have garnered new customers and done fairly well, taking those from community banks and regional banks in the US. Interesting to see. But they also raise the issue of the tech players, competition between fin and tech. And so when we look at Alipay and Tencent WeChat Pay, we certainly see tech fin as being the big disruption in China. And then you've got Goldman in the US. But anyway, I'd like to, Alistair, get into what you're doing at Pollinate, talk about the upcoming Khalifa report. Well, actually, by the time this show airs, it will have been released. But let's just have a quick break, guys, and then come back and dive into that. You're listening to Breaking Banks. I'm here with Alistair Lukies and Matt Dooley talking about the history of fintech in the first half, and then we're going to get into some specifics in the second half. We'll be right back after these words from our incredible sponsors.
The Breaking Banks Europe podcast brings you European unicorns, startups, founders, regulators, and leaders all innovating in the rapidly evolving fintech scene.
Hi, I'm Matteo Rizzi.
I am Ajit Tripathi.
This is Matthias Kröner.
I'm Megan Johnson.
I am Paolo Sironi.
I'm Nina Mohanty. Join us and some of the world's most well-known hosts and influencers in fintech as we bring you insights into European fintech. Find us wherever you normally listen to your podcasts or at provoke.fm.
Welcome back to Breaking Banks. We have Matt Dooley in the chair in Hong Kong and Alistair Lukies in London joining us for this show. Alistair, you know, we've talked a little bit about NAB. They're a partner with you along with some other, legacy incumbent players in Pollinate. Tell us about the platform and, it appears to sort of try and act as a bit of glue for the disparate systems for merchants. But tell us a bit more about Pollinate and what the mission is and, how you got the involvement from these players.
Thanks, mate. And there's so many different ways you can describe it, but chatting to you and Matt, yeah, we sort of already got there because the data, and it's great to hear Aussies call it data rather than data, really what this whole thing's about. And the JP Morgan report you referred to, I think it's clearly a bit self-serving to say, if you haven't fixed it in the next few years, put yourself up for sale, because I'm sure they'll be the acquirer of some of these regional players anyway. But they're right, time is not on the bank side, no question about that. And the way that banks defended themselves historically, probably unwittingly, was by creating schemes, right? We've talked about JETCO. You look at Link, the ATM network, now VocaLink, faster payments. You look at MasterCard, you look at Visa. What happened
Union
is banks
Pay
got
in China.
To, yeah, UnionPay, Discover. I mean, there's tons of them. And what the banks did is they said, well, we'll create our own drawbridge, right? We're not going to let others in. And they did that over time, did it over decades. Visa and MasterCard, what's the combined market cap? 750 billion. Absolute machines. But, the banks, now see them as potentially part of the problem, because if you're Visa and you give away 15 basis points of interchange to Apple, which they did for Apple Pay, suddenly you're no longer supporting the legacy or the incumbents. You're working with everyone, and you're providing the rails for other people to do cool stuff like tech fins, as you described them. And they're definitely a bit more of a worry than a little old fintech, because if you've got a billion customers globally and you suddenly decide that embedding financial services is just the next thing you do after music, then that causes a few heart-stopping moments for banks. So, I suppose it's a bit like Stockholm Syndrome, Brett. I sort of go back to the hand of the abuser. I keep working with banks for some strange reason.
It started as NatWest's merchant acquiring business, right?
Tiny prelim to that. So right. I was very lucky to meet a guy called Rob Haver. Some of you may have heard of him. He was the founder of Capco, Belgian entrepreneur, just an amazing entrepreneur. He sold his business to FIS and then ended up buying SunGard as the joint CEO of FIS. And Rob wanted to go onto the investor side and partnered up with Warburg Pincus, and we created a fund called Motive Partners. Myself, Rob, Steve Daffron, who's now running Dun & Bradstreet, Mike Hayford, who's now running NCR, and a guy called Andy Stewart. And we got together and went out to meet a lot of LPs around the world, and all of them were getting pretty frustrated, I would say, with the 220 model, where you give $15 billion to a huge fund and they're not that incentivized to put the money to work, because if you're making 2% on the administration fee, that's pretty easy earnings. And so they wanted to get more into the domain, into the vertical. And so you're going to see a lot more of these specialist funds set up in all sorts of fusion industries, med tech, energy tech, you know, fintech.
Right.
So we raised a fund called Motive. And part of the thesis was that we would work with banks to find common problems. So non-competing geographic banks find common challenges that they face and say, rather than all of you go and spend 150 million building it yourself, why don't we build it once and share the IP? So an acceleration of schemes. And it's a bit like the Bain 10. You know, if you think of what the Bain 10 is now, that's more of a strategic committee, but they share learnings from around the world. So NatWest, Royal Bank of Scotland, under the leadership of Ross McEwan, were the first to join. Many other banks joined as well. There's many banks in the committee today. And the first challenge that we were set as Motive was, you know, we had to sell Worldpay. This is RBS. We sold Worldpay in 2009 for 2.015 billion. It's now worth 28. That didn't go so well for us. And we had to refer all of our small businesses to Worldpay for 10 years, which also kind of hurt. So every time a small business set up in the UK and banked with NatWest, they just got thrown to Worldpay and Worldpay picked them up as a customer. So there was a lot of frustration in NatWest as that was coming to an end. And Ross is so authentically passionate about small business. Actually, his daughter runs a coffee shop, and I think he was there most weekends doing the washing up in his pinny, and was seeing that the small business had to basically become a systems integrator. You know, she had spent about 26 grand on, you know, downloading software, getting terminals, getting HR payroll systems, you know, loyalty, all of this stuff. She'd had to become a real tech expert. And he's like, why can't we do that? Why can't we help with that stuff just as a Shopify or, you know, anyone else in the space would do digitally? And so he set us the challenge of, you know, can we go beyond the payment? Is there a new way of doing merchant acquiring? And back to Matt's great point earlier, the data being the acquirer of record is just so important to access that real-time data, as you were talking about Alibaba and these other companies. And so, and I suppose anyone that wants convincing, anyone who's listening to this saying, really, you know, does it really matter if you're the acquirer of record? Just ask Bank of America why they spent $1.9 billion buying First Data out of their joint venture in the US. So being the acquirer of record was really important. But what we looked at is the payment, because it's all a race to the bottom, right? Payments are going to be the cost of an email very, very soon. So is it all about that's just the data? That's the ticket to the game. What can you do beyond the payment? And so Ross gave me a license to operate and not hire a load of bankers. I do laugh. A lot of banks set up innovation centers and take the guy that used to wear a suit and put him in jeans and a t-shirt and then say, well, you're in charge of innovation now, mate. And all that person knows how to do is manage a risk committee. So,
and put on jeans, yeah, apparently.
And put on jeans, exactly. So we said to Ross, we would put together some digital natives, and I put together a team. You know, as you know me well enough, Brett.
You got about 100 people there, is it now? Or?
About 180. Yeah.
Wow. And you started like in anger in like late 2019, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Raised a bit of, well, we built from the ground up a new system within NatWest. So we spent 2 years just from the ground up, changing all the rules, attacking the policies, and just saying, look, if you're going to do a modern day, if you're going to compete with Square, yeah, you're not competing with FIS or Worldpay, right? You're competing with Square. So how are we going to do something as cool as that? And so, you know, sorry to coin a phrase, but breaking banks. Yeah, we sort of went in and said, we're just going to do this differently. And we stood up a system which is now called TIL by NatWest, T-Y-L, which stands for Technology You Love, and also the TIL, you know, your checkout. And we built this thing from the ground up. We partnered up with Fiserv, First Data, to use their rails because, you know, you don't need to build new rails. The rails are out there. You can use them. Partnered with Clover, their terminal, which is actually a great terminal.
Hmm.
But the most important thing is we built a new data lake. And you guys, you know how important this is because all the old banks' data and all the old legacy systems just meant it was so chunky and fudgy. And so we built a new data lake for them, which is really the Pollinate IP. And that ingests data from about 70 different sources in the UK, Companies House, Experian, Equifax, social media, the bank's own data. And so what we can do is we can authenticate a merchant in under 5 minutes. It's bloody cool. So in under 5 minutes, a merchant can literally go on online, say, this is my company, this is where I'm based, this is my postcode, this is my turnover, can I get merchant acquiring? They get approved in 5 minutes. They can start taking payments the same day, and they get a terminal within 24 hours.
That's amazing.
It was a lot of hard work, but
it really makes me think. I mean, Matt, you might have some comments on this as well. But with the success of Alipay and Tencent WeChat Pay, particularly on the merchant side in China, and now you know in 100 countries, and Alistair, you're talking about the change of this business is like. What do you do if you're MasterCard and Visa? Because the interchange model, how is that going to survive? It can't, right?
I think the one that was really leading the space, say, 10 years ago, was probably Amex. Amex had platforms. They had SME data. Amex, yeah. American Express.
Yeah.
American Express had those SME... they did a campaign, Link Love, and with that campaign, the Link Love campaign, and they did a fantastic thing called Small Business Saturdays, where it was trying to get small businesses using the Amex platform to actually connect these small businesses that couldn't compete on their own on the old high street. It was only the big brands that were winning. And they could actually provide the insight of how to target the right customers, but also get the deals. And they created that community. And I think in China, they took that model, but they went to the nth degree. The thing with, you look at the new payment model and the new fintech models of China, that's along the lines of new retail. And it was Jack Ma that coined that phrase, new retail. And they created their own supermarket, love the Herma store. And Herma supermarkets in Shanghai do the complete store, you know, supply chain on blockchain. So if a vegetable is picked at 3 o'clock in the neighborhood, that is all on the blockchain. So when you're actually in the mall, you can actually pick up the vegetables and see who was the farmer, where was it picked, the location, the time, the date. And it's that provenance and that extra thing with the data which creates the value and the real need. And I think looking to China, I think COVID's been a catalyst for the West, but this kind of mass adoption of fintech and the mass adoption
already happened in China. Yeah.
Already happened in China.
Yeah. And no, I think it certainly shows, like, you know, I mean, Alistair, I don't know what you think about this, but my view has always been the last few years, I've stated fairly repeatedly that, you know, in comparison with the US at least, which is still stuck with an ACH system, which is 3 to 5 days for transferring money bank to bank and their checks and, you know, all the other, you know, crap that goes on there, is that China's like, you know, 7 years ahead of the US when it comes to sort of basic SME retail payments, that wallet experience, where the wallet, the really interesting thing in China is that Alipay and Tencent WeChat Pay have taken over the role as the day-to-day discretionary spending account for most customers. What you'd have is a debit card in the UK and the US.
Right? Well, what my grandmother used to call jam jars of cash, right? So,
right.
You know, on the mantelpiece, she would have the jam jars. You know, one was for shopping, one was for holiday, and we always said, I mean, Brett, I remember you saying this, you know, some time ago, that actually, and I think it was Bill Gates, wasn't it, that said, you know, we need banking, not banks. If my DDA account, as they call it in America, you know, where I get paid my salary, and there are advantages, of course, for consumers. You've got the government, £250,000 guarantee on your savings, £85,000 in the UK. That stuff's important. And so as you think of the tech fins and the fintechs coming to the drawbridge of the banks, that not many people want to be a bank. It's not that exciting being a bank. But if I can persuade a consumer that the moment that salary check comes in, I put 500 in this account, I put 100 in that account, that's my discretionary spend, that's where my loyalty sits. That's where it gets exciting. And back to your question about MasterCard and Visa, okay? You know, for me, everything's about leadership. And, you know, I've had both of those firms as shareholders at various times over the last 20 years. There's a Harvard Business Review report that came out last week, study into the leadership at MasterCard. Rick Haythornthwaite, the chairman, Ajay Banga, the CEO, who for me is one of the greatest leaders of our business time. And if you look at what MasterCard did, is they had total acceptance of what you've described, this race to the bottom, this interchange challenge. So what did they do? They bought Vocalink. They bought faster payments in the UK. They said, we'll self-disrupt. If it's going to be the cost of an email, we might as well at least run the email systems, okay? So they started self-disrupting. They've done deals around the world. Look at Network International and some of the other payment rails they've got involved in. But why I'm so excited about where MasterCard are going, and I think, you know, Visa have chosen to kind of be all things to all people and work with the disruptors and work with the Silicon Valley guys. And, you know, when Charlie Schaff was there, you know, really enjoyed hanging out with the dudes at Google. But, you know, I question whether they've, you know, picked a path. Whereas MasterCard, if you look at the affiliate marketing model today and you look at all of that fat, all of that, you know, that revenue that goes. So my brother's a farmer. If my brother wants to sell goods online, not on the high street or Waitrose.com or Ocado, yeah, he's giving away 25% of his revenue. But of course, their argument is, well, you've got no cost to serve, right? Because you just grow the strawberries and you distribute them. And we're seeing these marketplace models pop up everywhere. What's really exciting about the use of this data now and the opportunity for MasterCard and the banks is to say, well, why wouldn't I be the introducer, right? Why wouldn't I close the loop between my small business customers and consumers? So we just ran a data profile last week across all of NatWest's 16 million retail customers. And we took one merchant, okay, one merchant that banks with NatWest, and we matched their data, and we saw within 10 square miles, there were 14,000 NatWest retail customers. And about 4% of those retail customers had shopped at this particular place. And so why wouldn't the bank then just put into my mobile banking app, we've got a friendly merchant, because you both bank with NatWest, there's a discount today. And it's nothing to do with...
It's pretty straightforward, right?
It really is, but it's just about... And then, of course, you get the guy in the bank saying, well, that's not what we do, right? We're bankers, we're not introducers. And you go, well, mate, I hate to point it out, but... Yeah,
that's where you got value at.
That's where you got. Yeah, so I hate to point it out, but actually, you know, having a supermarket where the only thing on the shelves are your own products doesn't work out that well.
Yeah.
So, you know, having other people use you as a distribution channel,
it's like business. If you think about SME business, you know, what does an SME want from a bank? Wouldn't it be great if I could just log into my bank account and instead of seeing account statement alone, bank statement alone, rather, that all my accounts were automatically populated in an accounting tool and that I had access to lawyers and I had cash flow projections. And you told me when I needed more money to grow my business because you could look at my cash flow projections instead of asking me for 3 years of financial statements to qualify for
mother's maiden name in a thigh measurement.
It's so simple when you look at it like that. But anyway, look, I'm conscious of the time, guys. We've got about 6 minutes left. Alistair, I wanted to ask you about the Khalifa review in respect to, you know, the sort of state of play of fintech in the UK, because we had this fintech strategic review released last Friday, and it's Ron Khalifa is the non-executive director of the Court of Directors at Bank of England, vice chairman of Worldpay, but you co-chaired this report. So tell us about what did this report say about fintech working with incumbents and you know, what are the main points you want to sort of talk about?
Well, yeah, Ron, you know, is known to many in the industry, obviously, you know, did a lot of the work to make Worldpay what it's become today. But Yeah, and he's just an all-round very solid guy. The government in the UK does these reports. So what it does is it commissions a report. Alison Rose did one on called The Rose Review about women in business. Years ago, the Stern, Lord Stern, did one called The Stern Report about climate change, which people probably should have read a bit more. Yeah. And so they asked Ron Khalifa to do one. And the reason I'm so proud, you know, I'm the first to bash Poms. I used to live in Australia, as you know, and lots of broken bones from playing rugby against big Pacific Islanders. And I, you know, I love beating up the UK as much as anyone. Historically, we've really been bad at this stuff. You know, we sat on our laurels, you know, very kind of emporial view of the world. And I'm really proud of the fact that this government has said, no, you know, just getting out there with fintech and doing a good job's not enough. How do we go again? Yeah, you know, how do we do fintech 2.0? And they commissioned this report. It's done by people across the sector. So there's loads of work streams. You know, what are the recommendations? What do we need to sort out? And it's been an 8-9 month process, which Ron has driven very hard. And the recommendations, which obviously everyone will have seen by now, is that we do a number of really important things. You know, talent, right? And you yep. talked about talent earlier. How do people get into the UK if they're a talented person in fintech? So we need fintech visas, right? We yep. need an accelerated visa to get people. You know, you've talked about China. We want some of that talent that have worked in growing Tencent and Alipay to come and work in the UK. So we've got to attract talent. We need scale-up capital. You know, one of the things in the UK that we have fixed over the last 15 years is it's no longer embarrassing to be an entrepreneur. Yeah, it really was 20 years ago. If you went to a dinner party and said you were setting up a business, people kind of looked down into their soup. It was a bit embarrassing. And so, you know, what we've got now is lots of seed funding. We've got really good early stage investors, and we've got a great London Stock Exchange. But in the gap, that thing that the Americans do so well, that $50 million, $100 million check, we need some of that scale-up capital. It's getting better, but it needs to get better still. So another recommendation is a fintech fund, which will fill some of that gap and create co-investment opportunities. A consolidation. I thought it was brilliant to hear Matt talk about what's happening in Hong Kong. We've got lots of fintech bodies. You know, we've got Innovate Finance. If you haven't heard of Charlotte Crosswell, you must have been asleep for a long time, because she certainly says a lot. And Innovate Finance has done a good job. There's the Fintech Alliance, there's Fintech Scotland, Fintech Wales, Fintech Northern Ireland, Fintech Midlands, Fintech North. So that all needs to come together and, you know, probably create some sort of CBI kind of equivalent for fintech. And then we've got these fintech bridges. And I know we're short on time, but I just want to spend 1 second on this. We created a fintech bridge with Australia, one with China, one with Hong Kong, one with Singapore, South Korea, most recently Canada. And these are government to government level agreements to agree, right? It's really, really powerful. And you get the regulators talking together. There's 53 different regulators in the international sandbox in London at the moment. And the reason it's so important, talking to any entrepreneurs on this, listening to this podcast, when you write your first business plan, the first thing you do is say, what's my addressable market? Okay. And your addressable market is 24 million people in Australia, it's X million people in Canada, or it's 60 million people in the UK. What's so cool about the fintech bridges is if we get regulatory collaboration across these countries, once you've been through a regulatory sandbox in the UK, why can't you just launch in Sydney the next day?
Right.
And so suddenly your domestic market is 200 million people, which of course the Americans have always had that advantage. You only need to crack one state in America right. and you're kind of home and hosed. So that's why I'm excited about the fintech bridges. But it's great to see the UK. And what you're going to see out of the fintech review, by the way, the Khalifa review, is we don't stop there, because fusion industries, if we all think of technology as all pervasive, does make me laugh. I still speak to bank CEOs who think there's a technology industry. And I sort of point out to them, it's not an industry, mate. It's, you know, singularity is not far. Yes. We just landed on yes. Mars, mate. It's everything. So, but if you think of financial services as the vertical and you say that became fintech in the fusion, same with med tech, same with energy tech, same with creative tech.
Exactly.
And so what
now,
we're going to
I say the new, by the end sorry, of 2030 that every leading player in every industry is going to be tech first and industry second. Correct. Right? So health tech.
Spot on.
I did have Spot William on. Russell on the show. I guess you know him, Alistair.
I do know our Lord Mayor, yes.
He
I
was
do.
Talking in about these same, you know, fintech bridges and so forth, and he was talking about his trips to Canada and the US and so forth for this. So, you know, it's clearly operationalized. I also see that there's a bit more focus on regional hubs. beyond yep. London, so Wales, where Starling correct. And Lonzo have set up shop, and Glasgow. So all very positive stuff, but unfortunately we've run out of time. So just to finish off here, Alistair, where can we find out more about what you're doing, about Pollinate? How do we stay tapped into that news?
Yeah, I mean, the FinTech Alliance in the UK is a platform. It's a not-for-profit government platform, which has got all the information about what's going on. So that's a good place to land. Pollinate, obviously, our website, as you said. Our model is to work with a bank per market. So we're working with NAB, we're working with NatWest, an African bank, a Canadian bank, a Brazilian bank. Just always on the lookout for great talent, great partners. MasterCard's a great investor in the business. And they've just, doubled down on their SME approach, another $250 million fund to support SMEs out of COVID. So the more we can do for small businesses, you don't need to be an economics graduate to know that if you don't have a Mittelstand, as the Germans do, or you don't have small businesses thriving, then your economy is fairly stuffed. So, but listen, most importantly, so good to connect with Matt, and always just make what you do for the industry is there aren't enough words to congratulate
brother.
You. So
thanks, brother.
Really, really amazing.
So if you want to follow Alistair on Twitter, it's L Lukies, A-L-L-U-K-I-E-S. We'll tweet that out. And he's on LinkedIn. Matt, thanks for joining us. How can people follow you?
Just Matt L Dooley
on Twitter.
On Twitter, yeah. Or on everything. Or Matt at connectedthinking.asia.
Right. Very good. Well, it's been great to reminisce a little bit. Al, great to catch up. I hope we catch up in person again soon. It seems like things are starting to come back. Fingers crossed. Vaccinations.
I'll be heading your way, mate. Don't come to London. I'll come to you.
Absolutely. We'll have a beer on the balcony in Bangkok.
Excellent.
And Matt, thanks for joining us. That's it for Breaking Banks this week, guys. Stay tuned. We'll have more goodness for you next week. In the meantime, stay healthy and be fintech ready. Talk to you soon.
That's it for this week. If you like the show, make sure to give us a 5-star rating on your favorite podcast platform, or share it with a friend, or share it on social media.
We'll see you again next week with more Breaking Banks.